Just a quick introduction for Dr. Dylan Vierkant, who works in the Department of Philosophy in Edinburgh University. I first came across zombies, so I was actually reading an article by his boss, Andy Clark, professor of philosophy, and I thought, what an interesting idea. It's what I often try and explain to people, what their brains are doing to them, and when they come along to the chronic pain clinic. And Till's done a lot of work on this. He's come over from Munich a couple of years ago, and probably better to leave him to explain what I only partially understand. So here we go.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I hope I will be able to explain my philosophical terminology to you so that it's understandable. But in case there are any problems, let's just get that clear from the beginning. Do interrupt, please, because you never know. Sometimes I get carried away and I might just chat about things which you have never heard about, and it's fair enough to interrupt and to say, stop, what are you talking about? Yes, what am I talking about? Again, I'm not a specialist in pain research or in the field of pain, but I'm interested in phenomenal consciousness. And many philosophers have used pain as one standard example for what is special about phenomenal consciousness. So what I'm going to talk about today really is this question. Can we ever understand the conscious experience of pain scientifically? That's the question that I want to think about with you. And I wanted to introduce you to a couple of philosophical puzzles of contemporary philosophers who thought that probably we can't. So whenever you go to an interdisciplinary conference on phenomenal consciousness, you will meet some of these types. They tend to be informed by David Chalmers. He's the guru of these new dualists in the philosophy of phenomenal consciousness. And these people try to explain to you, like you as empirical practitioners of a science that has to do with empirical consciousness, will never truly understand what it is about, because you can't. There are principled reasons why you can't understand. And really what I want to do is just go through the puzzles and tell you in the end that it's wrong, but you can. And then say, on my last slide, why that doesn't mean that you should be too cross with philosophers and that there's still lots of room for an interesting collaboration between philosophy and cognitive science, empirical sciences. That are interested in phenomena of the mind. Okay, so that's the preliminaries. Let's get started as a short reminder of the, well, kind of contextualize the two puzzles that I want to talk about. Since Descartes, for a very long time, people were convinced that the mind has to be something that's very special. And it's the one thing that's not explainable by using the methodology of the natural sciences, the empirical sciences. And that only changed in the 19th century and at the beginning of the 20th century. But then it changed quite radically. There was a strong philosophical opinion in the behaviorists and the functionalists and identity theorists throughout, never mind the terms. But there were many philosophical schools who were convinced that now is the time, now the empirical sciences have enough power to tackle these the last riddles of the human mind and understand what consciousness, what the human mind is. And to do that was the empirical methodology of the natural sciences. And I guess this optimism kind of carried on until the late 70s, early 80s, especially growing, feeding on the enormous initial successes of artificial intelligence research, cognitive robotics research. So we kind of thought, well, we can do it now. We can, we're almost there. We can almost create intelligent, conscious, artificial beings. At the same time, the neuroscience has advanced rapidly, and we could make nicer and nicer pictures of the human brain. People were very impressed that you could localize now where things seem to happen, and people were thought sooner or later, this will give us enough machinery to understand how the mind works. But by the mid-80s, there had been a couple of very prominent philosophical skeptics, and they had come up with a couple of thought experiments which pour cold water over the optimism, and which seem to show that an understanding of phenomenal consciousness can't be achieved by the means of empirical sciences alone. The classics were the, I'm not going to talk about those three, The Chinese Room by John Searle, What Is It Like to Be a Bat by Thomas Nagel, and The Problem of the Explanatory Gap by Levine. What I'm going to talk about today are two further puzzles. One introduced by David Chalmers mainly, and that's the problem of the zombies, and another problem introduced by Frank Jackson, and that's the story about Mary, the colorblind scientist. And both of these experiments, thought experiments, seem to show that you cannot understand what phenomenal consciousness is at heart if you just use the methodology of the empirical sciences. So that sounds odd. Why zombies? What have zombies to do with serious talk about phenomenal consciousness? Well, obviously, philosophers aren't scientists, and they watch a lot of movies, and they get quite impressed by them, and so they start developing their arguments using freaky creatures like zombies. And here's a rough outline of the argument that we're going to look at in a bit more detail in a second. So here's how the idea goes. Well, okay, so one thing that zombies seem to be, they're pretty dead and they're unconscious. They're not, they do not have any mental life. They're dead. But they're not dead like normal people. They don't lie in their graves and are pretty quiet. No, they just get up again and walk and talk and behave as if they were alive, even though they're not. They do not have any life or mental life, but they behave as if. And that's the crucial point. Now suppose if it's possible that zombies, if it's imaginable that zombies can walk and talk without being alive, without having a mental life, if it's not necessary to have a mental life in order to be able to walk and talk and to behave as if you had a mental life, if that's possible, then it seems that probably in us, no, not probably, that definitely in us, it can't be because of the walking and talking that we're conscious. Because it doesn't seem to be, we can show in that case that it's not sufficient to walk and talk for being conscious. Okay, so if that's true, then probably consciousness in us is not reducible to walking and talking either. And if that's true, then behaviorism or physicalism, functionalism, must be false, i.e. the idea that mind is reducible to walking and talking, to behavior, or that mind is reducible to something that goes on in the brain, must be false. That's the general outline of the argument. But let's have a look at it in a bit more detail. So what exactly is a zombie? What kind of zombie am I talking about here? Am I talking about this? That's one notion of zombie that people have heard of, that Hawaiian zombie. So the idea is there might be people who are influenced by some kind of voodoo master, and because they're influenced by, because they're under the control of the voodoo master, they do the voodoo master's bidding. They're in a trance and they obey the sorcerer. But obviously this is not the kind of zombie that we're looking for, because this zombie doesn't just walk and talk without being conscious. The zombie still has some consciousness. So this, even if these Hawaiian zombies might exist, or maybe they don't exist, they're not what we're looking for. So is it this that we're after? Is it this type of zombie that we're after? The kind of Hollywood zombie, the zombies that we see in thousands of zombie films. Now, these zombies are quite good in the one respect, because according to the general script of Hollywood's filmmakers, these things really do have no soul. They're properly dead, but at the same time, they are pretty active. They run round and try to eat humans, and they do that. They are able to do that in a moderately intelligent way. So it seems like even though they're dead, they do have some kind of moderate intelligence. But then we're not after that kind of zombie either, because the Hollywood zombie is just a fiction, and probably that kind of zombie really couldn't exist. And if they couldn't exist, then they're not really interesting for our argument. We come back to that. Now we don't leave Hollywood, but we leave the traditional zombie idea behind. But something like Commander Data might be closer to the kind of zombie that we have in mind. So Commander Data doesn't seem to be alive, and he tells us all the time that he seems to be at least a partial zombie. He's a partial zombie because he tells us that he lacks something. He doesn't have one part of mental life. He doesn't have emotions. So maybe that is the kind of zombie that we're after. Would be nice if that would be the right kind of creature, because obviously artificial intelligence is one traditional way of where we might look for our zombies. But the problem is, Commander Data is not a very good zombie either, because the part of the mind that he lacks, i.e. emotions, does influence his behaviour very strongly. Because he doesn't have emotions, he can't behave in certain ways. He aspires to have these emotions, and as it makes a crucial difference to his behaviour, he doesn't walk and talk like we do in this crucial respect. So the respect of his mind that's lacking does influence his behaviour, makes him different from us. So what is it that we're looking for? And here is the zombie, the philosophical zombie. So the one thing that you notice is the only way in which they are different is they don't seem to age as much as their counterparts. But apart from that, the point about philosophical zombies is that they are exact copies of us. They are exact copies in appearance, but not only in appearance. They're copies in behaviour, so they behave exactly like we do. They are, even in the strongest form of the thought experiment, identical down to the molecular structure. And it seems that if this zombie is possible, that's the argument, then that we can prove that the mind cannot be physical. How is that? Well, because if this philosophical zombie could exist, then it seems that it's not different from us in terms of behavior, by terms of definition. So the two parts of the definition are, this zombie behaves exactly like we do. Behaves exactly like we do. It can walk, it can talk, but not only that, it can construct rockets. So the kind of zombies in Hollywood films tend to be relatively stupid. They can walk, maybe they can talk, but they tend to be visibly different from us. A philosophical zombie isn't. The idea about a philosophical zombie is that they are exactly like us in terms of behavior. So they can construct rockets, they can enjoy the sunset. Well, at least they say they enjoy the sunset. This means that if philosophical zombies are possible, then it's analytically true that behaviorism is false. Why? Well, because all behavior that we can exhibit is exhibited by the zombie. But by definition, a zombie isn't conscious. That makes a zombie different from us. So if that being can exist, then all behavior is not enough for consciousness. You need something else. It's not true that if you have exactly the same kind of behavior, all behaviors that we can exhibit are exhibited by zombies as well. But if that's possible, if we can imagine such a creature that behaves exactly like we do, and still isn't conscious, then that means, analytically, obviously, that behaviorism is false. And we can go on. It's not only behaviorism that is false, but if zombies are possible, then functionalism, i.e. the idea that our mind is, well, I guess the easiest metaphor is something like a computer software. It's not reducible to the behavior. We have to look into the black box, as it were, into our brains, but what our mind really consists in is some kind of software. We could still explain that within the physicalist realm. We wouldn't need to use anything freaky, strange metaphysics. We could use standard natural sciences if we want to be functionalist. In fact, the functionalist ideology was the mainstream ideology until the 1980s, and in some forms it probably still is. But if philosophical zombies are possible, and functionalism is false. False analytically. It's false analytically because zombies have exactly the same functional organization as we do. And if they're possible, if we can imagine a being that has exactly the same functional organization as we do and still doesn't have consciousness, then functionalism must be false. Because then all the function isn't sufficient to give you consciousness. You can have a being that has the same functional organization, but isn't conscious. And finally, you might think, well, maybe the functions won't do it. But the one thing, as a physicalist, that you might trust in, as a practitioner who works with people in the hospital, you might have a strong trust in brains. You might think, well, brains are the thing. If you have a specific brain, then you must have, if the brain is wired in the right way, has the right inputs, then you must be conscious. But that position must be false too, if philosophical zombies are possible. Why? The argument is exactly the same again. Philosophical zombies, by definition, are defined as creatures which are identical to us with respect to the molecular structure of the whole body and of their brains. Nevertheless, they do not have consciousness. But if it's possible that there's a creature that has exactly the same molecular structure as you have, and still isn't conscious, then in you, it can't be the brain either. That's sufficient for your consciousness. Your consciousness must be something else. It can't be identical in you either. So,
are you trying to encourage us to think in terms of there being a fourth dimension or another level that we're not usually thinking about?
You mean why? What is phenomenal consciousness? If this is right,
yeah.
Well, there are many different answers. You might want to say here, but at the moment, this is just a negative argument, and I'm going to say in a minute anyway what might be wrong with the argument. But it's, I think it's, what's good about this argument is I think it brings out a folk psychological intuition with philosophical precision. It brings out the intuition that pain and what you're interested in is not reducible to avoidance behavior, is not reducible to the firing of C fibers, as the philosophers use the standard example, which then probably is false, in, at least in this simplicity. But that's the intuition that we're trying to get at here and try to use for an argument. I think this argument is overshooting quite a long way. But having said that, that's my opinion. There are lots of very serious people out there who do believe that this argument works. What they can show analytically that the empirical approach to its pain is at least limited, always has to be aware of the fact that it's only, well, researching into something that is correlated to consciousness. The consciousness is correlated to the conscious experience of pain, but not the real thing. Well, in fact, that's what we were just talking about. So this is, if we're talking about zombies and pain, zombies have everything that you could possibly study if you rely on third-person methodology. If you don't study yourself, that's all you've got. You can ask them, but obviously zombies will answer in exactly the same way that a person with a conscious person would. You can prick them, but they will behave exactly like a conscious person would. You can scan their brain, put them into an fMRI scanner, but the fMRI will be the same because their brains are the same. So it seems that all that, looking at all that, is missing something. That's the intuition brought out by this argument. The intuition is all these third-person methodology can get you only quite a bit of the way, but there's a last bit, a so-called hard problem of consciousness that you cannot attack with this methodology. So, put another way, even if you had your perfect explanation of behavior and function of a being in pain, you still haven't explained why that being experiences pain and what it is like from the subjective point of view to experience pain. That's the intuition that this argument is driven by. And this is called the explanatory gap. All the explanation of function, behavior, or on the brain level doesn't explain the experience side. And if zombies can exist, then there is a proof, an analytical proof, that the explanatory gap exists and that you're doomed. But note what I always said very carefully, if zombies could exist. And that's exactly...
If you go back to the slide before, and you're saying you still haven't explained why that being experiences pain, I don't understand how you jump to that. I mean, if you're saying that you have a perfect explanation, and if all these various things happen, then that's
that creature or person or zombie will feel what you described as pain. I don't really understand how you say, I mean, if you replace that with, say, touch or sight or sound,
mm-hmm.
what you're saying is you're saying that process results in a sensory experience. So why?
No. What I would say, the same counts for sight, touch, etc. So what you, in fact, for the explanatory gap, people were actually talking about pain, but you can run exactly the same argument with sight, touch, or hearing. The idea is that all the behaviour that's associated with hearing or sight, and all the afferent and efferent nerves that are associated with touch, and all and everything that all the functions and neurophysiology that's associated with sight or hearing, will give you one form of explanation, a third person explanation of what's going on. But they will not explain to you, that's the intuition, why these nerves give rise to the conscious experience of pain. They don't seem to say anything about that. That's the crucial point. It seems possible to imagine that you had a creature, that's the zombie, who has exactly the same functional architecture, who behaves exactly like you do, who functional architecture, I can only repeat myself, has the same brain, but who nevertheless is all dark inside. That's the claim. If that's possible to imagine, then the argument goes through. That's all that we need. Do you see the point now? No. So what don't you see? You think it's not possible, or you don't understand what they're getting at?
No, I understand the argument, but I just don't understand that wee bit about how you still haven't explained why that being experienced as pain, because
it's obviously the emphasis is on experiences. You haven't explained yet the subjective side of what's happening in the brain. You haven't explained the first person side. And you haven't even started saying anything about it.
But how could
the third person perspective? Well, it couldn't. That's exactly the point. That's the point. That's the point where it seems that consciousness is different to all other scientific explanations. It seems once I've given a proper scientific explanation of, let's say, heat, or what water is, there are no questions left. Once I've got a complete explanation of the phenomenon, I'm happy. There don't seem to be any other questions. But when I talk about pain, that seems to be quite different, because you've now told me. Use the philosopher's simplification again. It's the firing of C fibers. Suppose that were true. Now if it's true that on the brain level it's the firing of C fibers, does that tell you anything about your conscious experience of pain? Does that explain? Do you have the feeling you've been given an explanation about your conscious experience of pain? And it seems not. It seems the two are not even related. Well, it's not quite true. It's not quite true that they're not related at all. They are related. What this explanation gives you is, if you look closer, that why you would withdraw your hand if there's something very hot. It explains to you why tears might run down your face, etc., etc. It explains lots of behaviour. It explains why you have certain patterns of brain activity. That all can be maybe explained. But all this, which, you know, is part of our brain experience, it's part of the brain experience that I want to withdraw from something that's hot. But it's not, It's only a corollary. It's not what's central about the pain experience. Central about the pain experience is the subjective what is it likeness, as philosophers call it. And that doesn't seem to be touched by the functional or behavioural explanations.
Is this something similar to the idea that you will know what my experience of the colour red is like?
Yes.
So it's, you can't understand
yes.
somebody else's experience.
Yes.
Yes,
it is something that you could start from. It's all a similar kind of idea. What's nice about the zombies is how far you can drive this argument here. Here, the interesting thing about zombies is it's nicely put in a way that shows you if that claim is true, what it means for all naturalistic theories of consciousness. It falsifies them. If zombies are possible, all these theories are wrong.
And are things like past memory and past experience considered too neural and scientific to bridge this gap? Or are they allowed to be ethereal and...
Well, a past... It's difficult because, obviously, what's a past memory is not something that I have phenomenal access to now. And I can only talk about... So it's not something that I have access to from the first-person perspective, because the first-person perspective obviously exists only in the now. So I can have a memory now about something that happened in the past, but I can't have a past memory.
Yeah.
So the access to a past memory, by definition, seems to be third-personal. What's
because you are talking about the neurophysiological
right.
function of brain,
right?
And you omit a psychic function of brain.
What's the psychic?
Well, the higher functions of brain.
Right.
So
well, I'm not omitting anything.
It's
I'm
leading us to a consciousness.
No. I'm not omitting anything because so far I haven't given you any details. All I've said is, and that's the beauty of it. It is an analytical argument. So it's simplifying insofar as we're just looking at these theories and see what assumptions they make and whether these assumptions could be true given the possibility of zombies. But let's move on and relieve you and say why I don't believe that zombies. What the problem with zombies is. Okay, a first hint of what seems to be strange about zombies is that they talk about their experiences. They call it qualia here. That's the term that philosophers use. But what we mean is conscious experiences. The first person, how it feels like to have an experience, how it feels like to be in pain, from the first person perspective. Now, zombies talk about that a lot. In fact, they talk about it exactly as much as we do, by definition. That is, because zombies are behaviourally supposed to be identical to us. In fact, they even write philosophical essays about them. And it seems that they even probably believe that they have them. Because that seems to transpire from the essays they write. In fact, there might be in zombie world, somebody like me might stand in front of you and explain you about the difference between me, who has consciousness, and the zombie, who hasn't. Well, but if that's true, then how do we know that we're not zombies? How do we have a good handle at all on, do we have an understanding of what it is that we're talking about that's supposedly different between us and them? Because it seems that, at least from the outside, they're absolutely indistinguishable. And in terms of their belief system, they seem to be indistinguishable too. They seem to honestly believe that they're not zombies. And if they honestly believe that they're not zombies, then, well, how do we know that we're not, have that we don't have false beliefs about our phenomenal consciousness too? That we are zombies just like them. And you might even go further, right? You might even go further and think maybe zombies aren't possible after all. Maybe when we imagine zombies, we imagine something like a round square. Now it seems we can say that. We can say there is something like a round square. And you might think, well, if I can say it, then I can kind of imagine one. But obviously you can't, because it's logically impossible that there is something like a round square. And if zombies are just as impossible as round squares, and it's just less obvious, because we understand very little about how the brain works and about how our own machinery works, then the whole argument falls down. So what the argument relies on, and that's where the philosophical discussion starts, is, are philosophical zombies like round squares? If they are, then we're in safe territory. If they're not, though, and you need to show only a very weak thing in order to make the argument go through. It doesn't have to be the case that philosophical zombies are a physical possibility. They don't have to exist here. They just have to be able to exist in a possible world, i.e. in a world that's logically possible. That's all that's required for the argument to go through.
And have philosophers always assumed that it's a fixed state, or is there any concept of the transient dynamic aspect to the zombie state?
What do you mean by that? I'm not quite sure whether I follow.
I mean, it's sort of thinking sort of about the theory of chaos and how things are always slightly changing, and you have your square turning into your circle and turning back into your square.
Oh, no, sorry. What? Obviously, something can be a square at some point and be a circle a bit later. Mm-hmm. But nothing ever is... It's not logically possible that something is a square and a circle at the same time.
Or changing from a square to a circle?
Well, that's possible, but it can't be a square and a circle at the same time. It can't be... Yes and no. It can't be P and not P. That's logical impossibility. Something can't be one thing and at the same time not that thing. That's logically impossible, and that's kind of as fundamental as we can go with what we can understand how reality could be. If something is logically impossible, then it just can't exist in no possible world. And that's what we would have to show. We would have to show that zombies are logically impossible. If they're logically impossible, inconceivable, then behaviorism, functionalism, identity theory might still be true. And whether that's true or not, that's what philosophers argue about. That's the exciting life they have. Okay, so if you think that, okay, this is all, it's a dubious story that you've been telling us here. Now, it sounds like you've given us a very, you sound like you think there's a strong argument here, but you accepted yourself that it's based on a at least very dubious metaphysical premise. So maybe we shouldn't use zombies as our only argument. But we don't have to. There's another one that I'm going to introduce you to, and before I try to sum up and give a way out. So here's the second puzzle. I think it's quite fun. That's even more famous by now than the zombies. It's probably the most famous thought experiment in the philosophy of mind of the last 100 years. And that's Mary, the colorblind, perfect neuroscientist. We could adapt her for this talk and make her the perfect pain scientist. Perfect because she knows absolutely everything there is to know about pain from the perspective of the empirical sciences. She's done it all. She read all the books, done all the experiments, but she's been an extremely lucky person because she never felt any pain in her whole life. She's been lucky that way. And the original experiment is she's the perfect colour scientist, knows everything about vision, but never seen the colour red because she's grown up in this lovely black and white house. So she's never seen any colours. So, okay, first important assumption. She knows everything. So this is difficult to imagine, but just accept it for the moment. This person knows everything. She has completed pain science, completed neuroscience, at least in the field of pain research, or at least in the field of colour research, but never seen a colour or never felt any pain. And now suppose that this person leaves her black and white room or falls on her face for the first time and hurts herself quite badly. Now it seems that this person will be surprised. Why would she be surprised? Because it will be something new for her. She will learn something. She will learn a new fact about life, about colour vision, or about pain research. So even though she knew absolutely everything that you could know from a third person perspective about pain research, even though she had the completed science at her disposal, falling on her face teaches her something. Seeing a red apple teaches her something. And now the argument, now if this is true, she learns a new fact. And if it's true that she knew all the facts that completed neuroscience can give you, that completed pain research can give you, then completed pain research and complete colour vision science doesn't give you all the facts about vision, because it's certainly a visual fact that she's learning. She learns what it's like to see red. That's certainly a fact about pain that she's learning. She's learning what it's like to fall on your nose. So she's learning a new fact, but physicalism claimed that all the facts there are to know are the physical facts that you can discover by doing third-person science. And therefore, physicalism is false. Another very powerful argument, but again, I don't... It's another way to get at the gap, just this time not in metaphysical terms, but in epistemological terms. So at first I was talking about what could exist, and this time we're talking about what could you know. So if you, and this time we're talking about completed knowledge, physical knowledge, doesn't give you all the facts on colour vision or on pain research, on pain, and... In the zombie case, we were talking about the ontological claim, metaphysical claim, whether zombies could exist or not. But obviously, even though this is a very, very influential thought experiment, it's not true that everybody believes it. Philosophers argue a lot about this thought experiment, and here is one counter-argument. One counter-argument is, well, true, There is something that happens, there is something new that Mary acquires, but it's not knowledge. She doesn't learn a new fact about how the world is. She just acquires a new skill to deal with the world. And all the theoretical knowledge in the world about how to ride a bicycle doesn't give you the ability to ride a bicycle. But that doesn't mean that if you learn to ride a bicycle, that you acquire a new fact, knowledge about facts in the world. You just learn, acquire an ability how to deal with those facts. So the physicalist claims the Mary argument doesn't work because it assumes a wrong concept of knowledge. It's not knowledge that we're talking about here, but it is a skill. Again, this is where the discussion starts, and I'm not going to go into it, but what I want to do now, and that's the last slide where I'm talking about why I think these puzzles are interesting, is, yes?
So in the last slide you talk about fact and a skill, but surely what you talk about here is an experience. I mean, why are they referring to it in one case as a fact and other case as a skill?
Well, that's something that, obviously, that you could debate the argument of Nemeroff and Lewis, who are the people who argue for the ability hypothesis, reduce what Mary learns to an ability. They say she doesn't, her experiencing the red amounts to a skill. So experience is analogous to a skill. That's the argument. It's different to learning something theoretically. It's a practical way of learning to deal with the world, an involved way of dealing with the world. But it's not new knowledge. That's the claim. So that's the claim is that this is parallel to a skill. You can have all the theoretical knowledge about riding a bicycle, still you can't ride a bicycle. You can have all the theoretical knowledge about what it is to see red, and you still don't know how it is to see red. You don't have the ability to distinguish red from blue, let's say. So the claim is this is what it reduces to. Whether you find that plausible or not is another story. There are lots of answers. This is one of the most popular one as an answer to the Mary argument. But obviously defenders of the Mary argument would say, well, no, that's surely not true. There are lots of ways in which you can say that. Well, Mary acquires certainly not a skill. One way, for example, you could say, Mary does not only learn about her way of dealing with the world, but she now understands what other people mean when they say, I can see something red. Now, if it's true that she acquires something, some information about other people, then that surely can't be explained away by a skill. Because it seems to be, because she's not involved. It's theoretical knowledge about the minds of other people by having now experienced red in herself. So, yeah.
But doesn't that theoretical knowledge count as a fact? And couldn't she, in fact, am I allowed to say that in this black and white box that she's spent her life, her accumulation of knowledge is always N being the final complete knowledge? -1.
Right. That's exactly the point. That's the point of the knowledge argument. If she doesn't have complete knowledge, even though she has complete physical knowledge, then physicalism is wrong. That's the claim of the Mary argument. The claim of the Mary argument is physicalism must be wrong because physicalism claims all the facts there are to know about colour vision or about pain research are physical facts, reducible to physical facts. And Mary shows you that's wrong. Finally, now I've told you why what might be problematic with both of these arguments. Obviously, they are hotly discussed in philosophy departments. and some conferences. But everybody accepts that there are problems with these arguments, and I just highlighted some of them. So one strategy that, for example, David Chalmers, who's one of the main supporters of these arguments, have run is to say, well, both of these have problems, but together they form a convincing argument. Because it's true that it seems like the zombie scenario seems to have metaphysical. It's doubtful whether we really can imagine the zombie scenario. But if you look at Mary, which is less metaphysically demanding, we seem to be able to imagine Mary much more easily than imagine a philosophical zombie. That seems to make the zombie scenario more plausible. And if that's true, if the zombie scenario can be made plausible, then, as I've shown, the zombie scenario, if it holds, the fantastic thing about the zombie scenario is once you accept this tiny little bit, zombies are logically possible, you've lost the whole match, because it means that then it holds analytically that you can't reduce consciousness to anything physical. So something that I developed at some point, thought I think is an interesting idea to show that these arguments are maybe just a bit of philosophical magic, is trying to turn the argument on the head, or well, just to let them run against each other and just see what happens. And I think you can show, or at least can develop an argument that seems to show that maybe Mary and the zombies do not work together but work against each other. Why is that? Well, what you can do is you just do the obvious thing and you combine the two. You imagine zombie Mary. So what would happen in a zombie world with a perfect, colorblind, or pain-resistant neuroscientist? And the fantastic thing is exactly the same as in our world, it seems. It seems that when zombie Mary leaves her black and white room or falls on her face, she will utter, oh, that's different. I never thought that pain feels like that. I never thought how wonderful it is to see the colour red. She will have exactly the same new capacities, the same new abilities as zombie Mary, as Mary. She would, if that's how we should read the Mary argument, and people argue about that, she would not know how to distinguish red and blue. So, if all that is true for zombie Mary, then our intuitions seem to have been triggered by something that can't have, by definition, have anything to do with phenomenal consciousness in the Mary experiment. Because if it seems that zombie Mary is missing a fact, that surely must be false. It must be false by definition. Because by definition, in the zombie world, there are only physical facts about the mind. So zombie Mary knows everything there is to know about colour vision, or everything there is to know about pain research. And if that's true, if she knows everything about pain research, then what she can't acquire any new knowledge, because by definition she has all the knowledge. But if that's true in her case, why should it not be true in the original Mary case? So you might even go as far as to say maybe zombie Mary is even incoherent, And that would be lovely, because if Zombie Mary is incoherent, then at least one of the two arguments must be faulty. Because, if you think about it, Zombie Mary is, by definition, a perfect neuroscientist. Now, a perfect neuroscientist shouldn't have false beliefs about their subject. Because a perfect neuroscientist, a perfect pain scientist, and false beliefs about what it is that triggers you to say, oh, that's painful, don't go together very well. In fact, not at all. So if that's true, if you don't find any way to counter that, and I'm not sure how you could, then it seems that Zombie Mary isn't possible. She isn't possible because the intuition, the Mary intuition, says she would come out and say, oh, that's surprising. But she can't say that's surprising, because if she would say that's surprising, then she thinks that's something, a phenomenal experience. I never knew what it's like to experience red. I never knew what it's like to feel pain. But that's wrong in Zombie Mary's world. In Zombie Mary's world, she should know what it is that triggers her saying what she's saying. So it seems like the zombie world doesn't allow for the Mary story. And if it doesn't do that, then one of the two must be faulty. My particular guess is that the zombie world is faulty and that Mary doesn't tell you anything about the incoherence of physicalism. So, well, okay, this was the end of the long story about Mary and the zombies. So really what I wanted to do so far, and it's almost the end, is I wanted to introduce you to a puzzle about phenomenal consciousness that philosophers have raised, and that you might come across if you read the literature on phenomenal consciousness that is closely related to the pain field. And I wanted to show you how one can try to develop arguments against these seemingly impenetrable philosophical puzzles. And I want to close with the last slide on, okay, what have I done? Why did I do all of this? Did I just want to give you what you probably had before already? A strange feeling that you shouldn't trust philosophers, that it's interesting to listen to what they have to say, but that it's, as soon as you start to work seriously, you should not be too influenced by philosophical work because it's just trying to confuse you. Well, to a degree, yes. That's exactly what I wanted to say. And to a degree, no. Yes, because if you attend interdisciplinary conferences with philosophers on phenomenal consciousness, then you will find types, philosopher types, and more often actually, people who have been to many, too many of these conferences and come back to the hospital and then tell you how they now understand the world. And that can be harmful. It can be harmful. It can be harmful if you believe too strongly or are too impressed by these thought experiments. These thought experiments are dangerous tools, and I know of people, very clever people, who are impressed enough by these experiments to say that it can influence research in ways that's really dangerous. So my advice, if you that's why I put up the Zombie Mary. It's always worthwhile to look at the thought experiment again because they seem impenetrable, but they pump intuitions, and they're always worth a second look, and it's always worth to take them with a pinch of salt. So that's the one thing. That's yes, be careful of philosophical thought experiments and the logic and strong arguments that are derived, conclusions that are derived from these arguments. But no, I don't want to say don't trust philosophers, because I think these thought experiments are not just fiendish little traps. I think there are many ways very useful. They're useful in formulating clearly and as strongly as possible our intuitions about what's difficult about consciousness research and about the relationship between knowledge in a third person methodology and first person access, first person experience. So this is the one thing that they can do. They can help us clarify and make as strong as possible those intuitions, nicely formulated in the explanatory gap. So they can tell us what it is that we need to explain. We need to give an explanation of why we have this intuition that there is something missing. We need to give an account of that. And that's a problem that we should be aware of. We should be aware of the fact that if you tell somebody, well, you're in pain because blah, 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 functional story, that this can be, that you can have the feeling that there's something lacking. And the answer, and you have to try to, that's what we strive to find, is an explanation of why these answers are unsatisfactory. And it's not only that philosophy, and that's the second part, philosophy can not only help to clarify what the problem is, but it can help as well to a beginning of the solution and my personal suspicion of why, what's going wrong here in when we formulate those intuitions are a couple of things that I talked about before I started the talk with some of you, that a couple of the key terms in the discussion are unclear. Terms like, what is consciousness? People have millions of different definitions of what it might be. And philosophy can help of clarifying what it is that we talk about in different contexts when we use the term. We might wonder whether there is only one form of consciousness. Now, Bloch has a very useful distinction between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. And these might refer to very different things. Again, it would be a topic, it would be another talk to explain the difference in detail, but that might be a useful way to go. And finally, something that I'm interested in what the bracket's in, is how crucial is consciousness for specific mental ongoings? What do we need consciousness? What is consciousness for? How important is it for pain? Can we think of pain without consciousness? How crucially is consciousness related to pain? Or what I'm personally interested in, how crucially is consciousness related to another mental item like autonomy? And as we're already a long way over the time that I had now, I think I'll leave it at that. And if there are any questions, it's over to you now.
Thanks very much, Till. Some baffling concepts, and not really what I thought zombies were, in fact. So that's very interesting, and I think that what I was thinking of as a zombie is the thing that's going on inside our brain, the things that we aren't conscious of, and how much access we have to that, how much. Processing.
Right. Well, that, yes. I mean, that's something that, that's one reason why I like to give this talk. It's a useful metaphor that people use in the cognitive sciences, developed from the philosophical discourse. Zombies are black inside. So the black inside part is right. It's just that zombies were developed for an argument where zombies are black all the way up. So black all the way up means they can do what we can do with consciousness. They can do all the way up with black processes, subconscious, non-conscious processes. And so when people talk about zombies in the cognitive sciences, quite often they equate zombiness with unconscious. Mm-hmm. Well, True to a degree, but obviously not quite.
Something extra.
Yes.
As well. Yeah.
Has anyone got any questions?
Have you personal experience of people with chronic pain? I mean, has any of this developed from that?
No.
Or does this come from another angle?
No, this is I
there's really no difficulty with justifying the existence of zombies if you have experienced a lot of people with chronic pain. I mean, there's something switched off, there's something missing, mm-hmm. you know, in people who are experiencing this dreadful phenomenon, and that's why this is very interesting to me.
Right.
And further from that, have you got any solutions for us? how do we get back out of this again? How do we how do we turn the corner now?
Right. I mean, I hinted at that on the last slide. So two things. Let me start. I mean, this is just coming back to the first remark. It's zombies. It's something that you shouldn't say to a philosopher. So it's a good way of speaking in a cognitive science context, but it's a dangerous way in a philosophical context, because if you say, yes, zombies exist. Obviously, as I've told you before, if you accept that zombies exist, then you accept that consciousness isn't understandable, pain isn't understandable by the empirical sciences. That's what you're saying, is that? But that's why I think it's good to understand what philosophers mean when they say zombies, and what cognitive scientists mean when they say zombies. It's just we should be careful that the two aren't mixed. If zombies are shorthand for being unconscious, for processes that are not reportable, let's say, but which don't give you the full functional story. So nobody would deny that there are empirical scientists, that there are processes which are conscious, whatever that may mean. Like what exactly that means is then cause for much debate. But there seems to be something that's interesting about conscious processing, let it be a global workspace or whatever. But philosophical zombies would have global workspaces. They just wouldn't have the phenomenal side of it. They would have what Ned Block calls access consciousness. They are obviously able to integrate all information rationally, but they don't have the feeling, the what is it likeness. And yeah, solutions. Well, as I said, good solutions to the philosophical puzzles are not to be to look closer whether really the assumptions of these thought experiments really hold, and I suspect that they don't. And once you feel satisfied that you don't have to be troubled by the thought experiments, you then can return and use the terminology in the harmless way. I really don't have any solutions to the particular case of pain. I'm very interested in the difference between implicit processing and explicit processing in other contexts. But that's a discussion that you can only start to have once you've been through the puzzles.
The only way to be a complete pain clinician is to experience severe chronic pain.
Yes, that's kind of what you would have to say. I can treat it just the same if I never had pain. Because I've got everything from the third person perspective that I need to treat the functional aspects of it. I'm not a perfect pain scientist because I don't know what it feels like. So I'm perfect in one sense. I can help people just in the same way that I could if I was the true perfect pain scientist. But I wouldn't be quite perfect because I wouldn't know what I'm doing, really.
But even if you'd experienced a chronic pain, that still wouldn't be sufficient because anyone's experience of chronic pain is completely different from anyone else's, just like the experience of the colour red or the colour blue, etc. Probably unanswerable problem.
Well,
you can never be a perfect
chronic pain clinician. Well, I suppose that. Well, two things. I mean, the argument is a negative argument. So there are no argument. It's a negative argument about what pain can't be, i.e. it can't be completely reducible to the physical side. It's not an argument that says that therefore that we've got no reasons to believe that our pains are that our phenomenological pains are similar or not. So that would be a completely new discussion. So what it takes to know, to have at least a decent suspicion, a working knowledge about other people's pains, it's a different question. But yes, I mean, it's certainly one of the absurdities that you could try to argue for to make the position implausible. But it wouldn't help you if one of these arguments go through. It's uncomfortable, but as long as the arguments hold, at least, I mean, there are in their core negative, and the negative conclusion doesn't go away if we can't find a good positive alternative.
There's a question there.
Well, there's two questions really. One is, can you explain again the difference between access consciousness and normal consciousness? And the other one is, like, there's certain conditions where you can't feel pain, but those people are obviously living and can experience sadness or happiness or whatever. Can't feel pain, so
wouldn't that be an argument that you could explain pain sort of as a neuroscientific process? Okay. Let's start with one. One, access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. I think it's what the idea here is that we can have, we seem to talk about two very different things when we talk about something as being, as a state being conscious. And one idea is that it's available for rational control. So if a state's conscious, then we seem to be able to use the content of that state to control our behavior. We seem to be able to use that content in, for example, rational thought. If I'm available, if I know that the apple is red, I can consider deliberate about the fact now that it's red and what that means. That means that it's probably ripe or poisonous or whatever. So it's available for wide processing. That's the idea of access consciousness. It's, or if you want, it's available on a personal level. So I can report it. That would be the simplest way of phrasing it. Access consciousness states that I can report on are access conscious states. Phenomenal consciousness, on the other hand, is the thing that we're talking about here. It seems that access consciousness doesn't seem to capture everything. And there are these arguments are some arguments that drive this intuition, but there are others. The one that Bloch uses is a Chinese nation, where he says, "Well, imagine you had the Chinese nation." Needs to be a big Chinese nation. They all are neurons. They all play neurons. So they send signals to each other in the same way that neurons would. Just they give little letters to each other or press little buttons. And they are electronically connected. Now, if they could copy the functioning of the neurons in that way, nobody would believe, Bloch says, that therefore the Chinese nation would have a phenomenal experience of red. They could function like the brain, they could do exactly the same thing, but there doesn't seem to be anything phenomenal. So there seems to be something missing, and that's again this hazy, strange, phenomenal thing. So that's the differentiation between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. And obviously most of the models in the cognitive sciences that talk about consciousness tend to focus on access consciousness. So for example, if you talk about one of the most popular theories in the cognitive sciences nowadays about what consciousness is, it's the global workspace. And the global workspace by Bernie Bass is basically just a rephrasing of what Bloch says in philosophical terms, i.e. That states which are broadcast to all the subsystems of the brain, and that's what makes them conscious. It's conscious, the state's conscious because it's available for further processing in all the subparts of the brain, or in many subparts of the brain. So that question, access consciousness, phenomenal consciousness. The second question, remind me. States where you don't feel any pain. So the question here is, what does that mean? So this is what we have to look at. States where you don't feel any pain, you report it that you don't feel any. What does it mean not to feel any pain? The only evidence that we have for the fact that the person doesn't feel any pain is their report, what we take to be an honest report. Okay, and you would still say they are. Why would we think that they are in pain if they don't have any of the behavioural reactions or any of the functional?
Well, I suppose you're presuming that because they don't have any behavioural reactions, that they're not feeling any pain. That would be it, wouldn't it?
Right. Oh, so I didn't. I would. But then I still don't get the question. So I thought you were saying we can still we can not feel pain but still be in pain.
If certain people are born who can't feel pain,
right?
Who would keep their hand quite happy in a fire and somebody sort of smelt it?
Yeah.
But they could feel happiness and they could feel sadness. Would that not tie in with the idea that pain is actually a sort of summation of
Oh no! Oh, okay. Okay, I get the argument now. So, these people have a neurological defect, let's say, or are neurologically different, and they feel all kinds of emotions, but they don't feel pain. And you can explain that by saying, well, they're just like normals. Apart from the fact that they've got this neurological difference, and because they've got, so this means that the neurological difference is pain. Right, okay. No, it doesn't mean that, because it might be true that there's a correlation between pain and this neurological condition, and it might be even that in our world, having this neurological condition is an enabling condition for feeling pain. But that doesn't mean that it is the same as pain, because it could still be possible that in a zombie world, if zombies are still possible, then you don't get out of the general dynamic of the argument. So, in a zombie world, as in a zombie world, it doesn't make sense to talk about anything over and above. It still seems to be possible to posit the difference in our world.
Well, I think it's good food for thought, and we better have some food for food before they get fed up with us next door. But I think we could probably carry on having a chat. There's not quite so many of us, and probably have a chat over dinner. So we'll probably go out this way. I'll clear up the stuff here. And once again, I'd like to thank Till for giving us a lot of really interesting concepts, and as an anaesthetist, I'm quite interested in consciousness as well as in the pain, and I think that you're right, there's some things that we're really going to be having a bit of difficulty explaining, even though we know all the facts. So thanks very much again.